So a couple of years ago, Mike Burnett and I had a conversation, and every now and again there come out on Lifetime or Discovery Channel documentaries about how the Exodus could have happened and what the 10 plagues could have been in biological fact, which to me, as I said to Mike then, completely misses the point. One thing, as our sages said, if it were physically possible, it wouldn't be a miracle. But more importantly, I think to me, when we try to dissect the difference between Torah and science and history, we are missing what Torah is there for us to give to us. Torah, the word means teaching, instruction. It does not mean a science book or a history book. I've never seen a free body diagram in the entire scroll. I've never seen Mendel's charts of propagation in there. They're not in there. They wouldn't be interesting. You don't get headings for histories and dates. That's not what the book is about. But what is really interesting this week, you know, the tension between science and religion comes up most strongly at these moments when we study Bereshit, Genesis. And there is some interesting parallels between the way science understands the world and the way some of our tradition has understood the world. So I don't want to, as I said, miss the point and say that's the point of Torah, that, you know, the creatures were created in roughly the same order that natural selection describes them being created. That's a tenuous assertion at best. But what is interesting, I found, it starts with the word Bereshit, which is this very weird shaped word. If you know biblical grammar, it doesn't really line up with any construction we understand. It means at the beginning, in the beginning, when God began, first of all, more or less. But Sforno has this wonderful, he's an Italian commentator, wonderful comment on the word. He says that it refers to the beginning of time, that it's the first indivisible moment before which time did not exist. So I checked this with Ted. This is all the science in this has not been peer-reviewed, just so you know. It's awaiting peer review. But there is a T equals zero in the creation of the universe, that at some point, if you look far enough back at the cosmic background radiation and look into the early quantum fluctuating field, there was a time before time, or there was a time when there was no time. So in that way, Sforno is really capturing something intrinsic to existence, that we exist in a linear experience of time, but once upon a time, there was no time. That's a good tongue twister. And there's a Hasidic teaching that sort of elaborates on this, that says, you know, why did God create the world when God did? You know, God could have started a million years earlier, or which would have been just as good a time to create the world. And what the Hasidic teaching tells us is that time was part of creation, which I think is this lovely image. And it's really striking because one of the great human struggles, even in science, is to explain time and why it more or less only goes linearly forward, that we haven't found any quantum exceptions whereby time can flow backwards. We can alter experiences of time, but it only goes in one direction, and I think the assumption is at a point before a certain point, there was no time. And our tradition explores this further. I'm glad we actually did the blessing for the new moon, the new month, because the first mitzvah that our rabbis agree upon is in the book of Exodus. It's the blessing for the month that starts for Pesach. It says, here's the ordering of the calendar. Here's the month that will be the month for Pesach, for Passover. So that's the first mitzvah, the first requirement we have to live Jewishly is to ordain a calendar and to organize it and to order it and to order our lives according to calendar. So in a very interesting and very touching, meaningful way, I think our tradition recognizes that time is a precious resource and that even science can't fully grasp time. I find to be a very interesting way to think about science and religion together. There are questions, ultimately, that science can't answer or whose answer is not really meaningful, whose answer doesn't add value to your life. But religion also grapples with those in a different way such that you come out of it with a sense of fullness. And our tradition was deeply, I think from the beginning, ambivalent about interruptions of physics and biology. That it recognized that questions of miracles and divine providence and God actively putting God's finger into the reality of existence were dangerous. They were hard to believe. They create more problems than they solve, because if God can, let's pick one of these examples, swallow Korach up in an earthquake, if God has that power to split the earth at any moment, why doesn't God rescue children from leukemia or rearrange things in Syria? Why isn't God actively intervening to our eyes? So very early on, our tradition recognized the deep ambivalence and problematic nature of miracles and said, you know what? Miracles were there before. They're not interruptions in physics. They were planned as part of the physics in the beginning. So Pirkei Avot, the wisdom of our sages, says that there were 10 things created right before Shabbat began. The very last things, among the last things God created, were these 10 things that we would call miraculous. What I mentioned, the swallowing of Korach, the earthquake that would swallow Korach, the well that Miriam would find, the talking donkey, the mouth at least, was a miracle. The rainbow, the manna, Moses' staff that could turn into a snake, and the shamir, which is this little worm. It's a piece of halakha. You can't use iron implements on holy stone, or so the Torah seems to say. So they believed there was a sacred maggot-ish worm that would carve the stones, the shamir. So that was created right before the end of the first week, right at the beginning of Shabbos. And then the writing, the inscription, and the actual tablets of the Ten Commandments, because recall, they somewhat float in the air. Their inscription is the same on both sides. They have a miraculous nature to them as well. So they really were discomforted at a very early phase of our tradition with the appearance of miracles in Torah and the appearance of the unnatural in our sacred works. Because why not us? Why aren't we experiencing that even today? Why don't I get to see magical things happen? So that said, I think they were, that you could make an argument, not an easy argument to make, that our tradition favored physics and biology, that those two domains, it was willing to concede that science works as science does. That there's a phrase in our tradition says, "Ha'olam noheg k'minhago." The world goes on according to its tradition, according to its custom, meaning there's a natural order to things. So then what is our place in that natural order? And what do we, with our rational minds and our scientific capacities and our technological innovations, do when faced with nature? How do we make it holy? There's a lot of verbs in this week's parsha, each describing sort of a different aspect of human relation to creation. I don't have them exactly in order because I want to end on one. So we're told that we sort of stand on top of creation. We kivshu, we conquer it. And then there's one of the first humans is named Cain, which means he grabbed or he took it. So we take creation, we hold it down, we walk over it, we subdue it. That's the most common translation you'll see. Those are very strong approaches to the natural world. It's a very chauvinistic isn't the right word, but triumphalist approaches, overweeningly prideful approaches, hubris, as far as the natural world goes. But the one that I think sticks with a lot of people is le'ovda u'le'shomra, which means to work upon the land, to serve it. Avodah, remember, is both worship and sacred service in the temple and just work in the fields. To have sacred service of the land, u'le'shomra, and to guard it, to keep it. We are custodians. We are stewards of the land. And as scientifically minded people, you know, you get this whole story of Adam, the second story of Adam, naming all the things. You know, that one's a platypus, that one's a walrus, this is Eve, so on and so forth. And Thoreau says that a name pronounced is the recognition of the individual to whom it belongs. He who can pronounce my name aright, he can call me as and is entitled to my service. That's a basic piece of science, is naming things, nomenclature and taxonomy. That we as humans are endowed with this incredible capacity to perceive the natural world, to give it names, to call it by things, and to recognize it, I think is what Thoreau is saying, to understand its nature, at least in some small way. You know, if you think about all the studies that have been done on fruit flies, how much we must so poorly understand a fruit fly even still, but we have made our efforts to understand the natural world, to know about meerkats, and to know how sinkholes open. It's very beautiful. And God gives us this clarity of mind, I think even fundamentalist Christians would agree that our faculties are divinely endowed. And I would never debate that. I think our faculties of humor and intelligence and kindness and generosity, even though we can find sociobiological explanations for them, they surpass understanding. And I mentioned in a holiday sermon, there's this weird conjunction in this week's Parsha, the very end of chapter 2 and the very beginning of chapter 3. Now recall, we don't break things into chapters. That was a later Christian addition to separate the chapters. So it's really in the same aliyah. And in one moment, we're told that Adam and Eve, Adam and Chava, were naked, arumim, to be plural. And the very next moment, they introduce the serpent, the lizard of what it was. And they say he was arum mikol chayat. He was the most arum of all the animals. So arum sort of means naked, but it must mean something else as well. Because Adam and Eve are definitely naked. That's the description they're intending for. And the serpent, well, he didn't have a serpent skirt on or anything like that. But it wasn't just that the serpent was nude. It was the serpent had a certain kind of clarity. So I think arum, if you look at the understanding of the Bible in biblical dictionaries, it implies something about cunningness and shrewdness and clarity and the ability to put things together in piles, also is what you find in dictionaries. So this is a faculty we get. You know, there's an ambivalence about it because it's a faculty first described in the serpent, who is not a pleasant creature, who is a tester or a tormentor of the early humans. But it's a faculty we all have nonetheless, and we should take as blessing. So then what's the point of being here, of being Jewish? What does religion offer us to inform those faculties, to inform our understanding of the Big Bang, to inform the way we go about and give life names and look over and steward nature and recognize the miraculous even in nature? So this is, I found another great midrash this week. The Torah says of itself, I was the tool of God's artistry, meaning that an architect who builds a palace doesn't do so without plans. You got to have your blueprints. You got scrolls and notebooks and engineering documents and books and a slide rule once upon a time. So it was with God. God looked into the Torah and created the world. Just a very mind-altering understanding of how the world was created. And I think reinforces my position, that the Torah is not a book of science, it's a book of meaning, and through that book of meaning, the world was created. That through understanding depth and love and passion and wisdom, that the world comes out of the quantum background radiation. For reference, this sermon is called God Moving Over the Face of the Cosmic Background Radiation. So I thought that was very clever of me. Arum, very arum of me. Yes, thank you. Perfect. But this is what I want to leave you with. So God looks into Torah and creates the universe, but the Zohar, one of the early mystical books, gives this caveat, or gives this codicil, so to speak. God looked into the Torah and created the world. Man looks into Torah and sustains the world. I think you all know I love science. I think it's fascinating. And I love math, and I love how things work. But they don't necessarily, they can inform the fundamental questions of why we exist, but that's the point of Torah, is to inform the fundamental questions of what are we doing here. You look into Torah, God looks into Torah to find reason to create the world, and we look into Torah to find reason to sustain the world.